Things of interest before we go now to Luke chapter 8. I'm sorry we left this hanging from last study, but hopefully we'll be getting into it. Hopefully, for sure, we'll be getting at least one revelation per week, and then the rest probably in the area of the miracles. All right, you remember this is the miracle that was interrupted, and as you begin in verse 40, the crowds welcome Jesus, a man comes to them, and his daughter is dying, and he asks Jesus to come. And as Jesus starts out, he is interrupted. To my knowledge, this is the only miracle in the life of Jesus that has a miracle inside of a miracle, or a miracle within a miracle. And we looked at that miracle of the woman with the hemorrhage on Sunday night, and we concluded down through verse 48. Now we're ready to continue on. But let me say something in a preliminary way before we about miracles before we get into the miracle itself. We have mentioned that one of the good ways to read the miracles is in a harmony, where you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John on one page in columns, with the matching material next to one another. And if Matthew includes a section and Mark leaves it out, then the Mark section that matches that is simply blank. So you can read it together. Now, you do have, again, always in reading these accounts, the problem of harmony. The problem of harmony that exists with the miracles found in the New Testament, or the events narrated by the New Testament. And let me say several things about the problem of harmony. What do you say when one author includes something that another author does not include, or one author expands and tells us a lot more than the other does, or there are times when one even seems to contradict the other? And therefore, you have a problem of harmony. And the first thing to note is this. The authors of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all had what we might call a common data bank. And in that data bank, John makes the comment that there is so much material there. And I'm sure he's using a hyperbole when he says that all the world could not contain the books that would record these things. And so you have a common data bank that is very, very large. From that data bank, each author selects, the authors select their facts. Here's an important thing. They all give facts. They do not all give the same facts. In other words, what Matthew might include, Mark would not include. And on what basis do they select the facts? The basis on which they collect their material is point to be made. Point to be made. Remember, no event is ever reported fully. There is no such thing as a full report of any event. If you go, for example, to a wedding, there is no way that you can report everything that happened. You say, well, if you made a video recording of it and if you made an audio recording of it, no, you wouldn't, because you still missed one thing. When Mr. Smith started to nod, Mrs. Smith gave him the elbow. That really happened, but you didn't see it. and there is no event. What about the attitudes and the thoughts that went through people's minds during the occurrence of that event? There is no way that could all be specific. And we have emphasized before, as an example, a biography of Eisenhower. And you could have four biographers all coming to the same data bank and all telling a slightly different story. Let's suppose author A wants to prove what he was like as a president. And so he goes to the data bank and he selects only the things that have to do with being a president. But let's suppose the other wanted to do something different. I am not concerned about his presidency. I'm concerned about his being a general. And he would go to the same data bank, but he would select different material because he wants to make the point that he was a good or a poor general. Another man wants to make the point that he was a good president or a bad president. Someone else comes along and says, have you ever considered this man as a father? And this person goes to the same collection of material and he pulls out his material based on the point that he wants to make, and he pulls out all of these things. Let's suppose someone else, and I don't even know whether this category is true, but I'll make an assumption just for the sake of the illustration. Let's suppose someone finds out that he was quite a gardener. And they would write from the same data bank, and they would pull it together and establish those things that made their point. Now, the thing to be emphasized is this. Point to be made, Matthew has one, Mark has another, Luke has another, and John has another. And therefore, unfairly, some come along and they'll say, well, look, Matthew reported this, but Mark left it out. Maybe he didn't know about it. That doesn't make any sense. These were intelligent men. And they wrote in line with the point they wished to make. And that's why sometimes between these accounts, for example, the one that looks at him as a general might describe him always as to uniform. The one of a father might describe him from another aspect of his dress. Contradictions? No, they're not contradictions. They're simply contrast in accounts due to each wishing to make his own point. And therefore, whenever we read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, one of the interesting things that you can always learn is Matthew wants to see Jesus as king. Luke, for example, wants to show Jesus as human. And it's interesting then that all the little facts that come in support these points. For example, every time Jesus is said to pray, only one of these four men really pick it up. Luke. Why would Luke pick it up? Because isn't it appropriate that men pray? And consequently, you have a great emphasis on that particular type thing. John uses the word believe about 100 times. And I'm not sure which is which, but the most that is found in Matthew, Mark, or Luke is 19. Now that doesn't make one accurate and one inaccurate. It is simply saying let's pull together a library of books concerning the miracles and so forth of Jesus that are there. And most of our problems of harmony come because we really don't see this particular thing. Mark doesn't have to record the same events that Luke did. You know, there are plenty of events. He selected the ones that he chose to select. Now, one other thing. And for this, let's put together the word prophecies, the word fulfillment, and the word meaning. First, prophecies. And I'd like for you to look at two places, Isaiah 35, verse 5, and 61:1. And in doing so, pretend that you are a Jew. And as a Jew, you have heard these prophecies about what one called the Messiah is going to be and do. And let's list four things that you would clearly be looking for if you were a Jew anticipating the Messiah. If the Messiah couldn't do these things, he simply would not be the Messiah. 35 and verse 5. And notice back in verse 4, say to those with anxious heart, take courage and fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. So notice this is an appearance of God. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened. And so notice there will be a opening of eyes of blind people. Second, the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. And verse 6, the lame will leap like a deer. And the tongue of the dumb will shout for joy. And this was all understood to be the things that the Messiah will do when he comes. The blind will see, the deaf will hear, the lame will leap, and the dumb will speak. Now all of those, with many other things, were part of Jewish mentality. They were part of the prophecies that were there. And when John the Baptist asked a question one day, is Jesus that Messiah? The Lord takes them to these passages to show them. Isaiah 65, or 61, verse 1. And notice, the Spirit of the Lord God has come upon me because the Lord has anointed. The word anointed is the word Messiah. The Lord has Messiah'd me. And that is the Hebrew word Mashiach for Messiah. The Lord God is upon me because Yahweh has Messiah'd me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to captives, freedom to prisoners, etc., etc. So notice you have at least four things that are going to be true of the Messiah when he comes. So you have all these prophetic events. And so you go from your prophecies forward to a second thing. And all of these cause, in Jewish mentality, for them to look at anyone who said, I am the Messiah, and ask this question. Can you heal a blind? Can you heal the deaf? Can you make lame to walk? Can you make the dumb to speak? And may we say, if Jesus did not do those things, he is not Jesus Christ. No possible way. Now, notice at some fulfillments. And let's take first the blind. Matthew 9:27. Matthew 9:27. And we'll simply associate one of many things we could associate with it. Matthew 9:27. I think most people never make a link between the miracles of Jesus and the Old Testament. And the miracles are that which binds the two together to bring us to a conclusion that Jesus is the Messiah. So we'll look at the prophecies, and then we will look at the historical fulfillment, And then we will look at the conclusion that we should come to. So we have the prophecies, the historical fulfillment, and then finally, the conclusion that we should come to. And what we're doing is tying the Old Testament, the life of Jesus, and the rest of the New Testament that calls him Jesus Christ all together. So tonight we're really making a definite link and tie-in with Old Testament, the Gospels, and the rest of the New Testament. All right, very simply then, let's look at the blind man. And we have one example, chapter 9, verse 27 of Matthew. I'm going to stick with Matthew and Mark. And Jesus passed on from there, two blind men following, crying out and saying, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." And in the context, the Lord touches their eyes in verse 21 and verse 30. Their eyes were opened. So, under the blind, let's put down as a sample passage Matthew 9, 27 through 31. Not the only one, but since the Old Testament says the Messiah will open blind eyes, Matthew 9 links those two together in terms of fulfillment. The deaf. The deaf. Well, let's get the others first because we want to move to Mark for the deaf. Let's go to the lame. The lame, Matthew 8, 5. Matthew 8, 5. And when he entered Capernaum, a certain centurion came to him entreating him, saying, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering great pain." And he said to him, "I will come," this is Jesus speaking, "and I will heal him." And the centurion says, "You don't have to come to my house. You can do it from a distance." And in verse 13, Jesus says to the centurion, "Go your way, let it be done unto you as you have believed." And so you have a fulfillment of the lame walking. And we're looking at Matthew chapter 8, 5 through 18. And what does the event of making the blind say? Jesus did what the Old Testament said the Messiah would do. And making the lame man walk, Jesus did what the Old Testament said he would do. Look at the dumb. Matthew 9, 32. And as they were going out, behold, a dumb man, demon-possessed, was brought to him. And after the demon was cast out, the dumb man spoke. And the multitudes marveled, saying, "Nothing like this was ever seen in Israel." And therefore you have chapter 9 of Matthew and verses 32 through 34 as fulfillment of that. Look at Mark 7. Mark 7. See, the miracles were not mere entertainment. They were not just acts of mercy. And again, if you would ask most people, why do you think Jesus made the blind men see? The answer would probably be he was very compassionate. Well, that's not the answer. He was compassionate, but that's not the answer. Why did he make the lame man walk? Because he looked at the guy and saw, "I really feel sorry for you. You haven't walked all of your life, have you? I'm going to make you can walk so you'll feel good and be happy." Not at all. That's not the purpose of the miracles of Jesus. Jesus did look at this man and say, "Wouldn't it be wonderful to send him home speaking to his family and his friends? I think I'll make him speak." That's not why he did it. Now that does not mean he was not compassionate. It doesn't mean those motives were not involved, but that's not the primary reason at all. The primary reason at all of these things, he made a blind man see. Remember the prophet Isaiah said the Messiah would do that? And you're supposed to come to a conclusion that Jesus then must be the Messiah. And the conclusion that is desired is for men to say, Jesus is the Son of God. He is the Messiah. That's what they're all about. But let's look at the Mark account, chapter 7, verse 31. Trifocals are awful. I'm trying to do like this and that. 7:31, and again he went from the region of Tyre and came through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee within the region of Decapolis. And they brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty, and they entreated him. And Jesus says, verse 34, in Aramaic, Ephphatha, meaning be open. And his ears, verse 35, were open. Impediment of his tongue was removed, and he began speaking plainly. So notice you have a deaf man made to hear, and this is in Mark 8:31-37. And let me put with these a plus many more. As John said, I had no problem picking out things to make my point. There was plenty of evidence. There was much there from that data file, and the data file was, I saw it, I heard it, I was there, I observed these things happen, the best possible evidence that you can have, which is firsthand testimony. And the conclusion to come out of all of this is found in Matthew 11:2-6. Matthew 11:2-6. And the conclusion is a doctrinal one, and it's a conclusion about Jesus. And notice the way it works. Verse 2, when John, this is the forerunner of Jesus, in prison, heard of the works of Messiah, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, are you the expected one, or shall we look for someone else? Are you the Messiah? And Jesus answered and said to them, go and report to John what you hear. The blind receive sight. The lame walk. Lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead are raised. The poor have the gospel to him. And so forth. And both of those statements there are pulling together the passages we opened with. They're pulling together Isaiah 35 verse 5, Isaiah 61 verse 1, and other portions. And Jesus uses that to prove to John what? That I am truly the Messiah. And so I think because of the common misunderstanding about the miracles being just nice things that Jesus did, they're much more than that. They are that which cause us to say, Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is the Messiah. And take the prophecies of the Old Testament, the life of Jesus, and then come to a conclusion. Jesus is the Messiah of Israel. See the way it ties together? That's an important concept as far as the scripture is concerned. Now, let's go back then and complete out the miracle in the time we have left. And we're at Luke chapter 8. And the first thing we can kind of box off here are the two messages that are found in verses 49 and 50. First, a message of futility. First is a message of futility, and it's found in verse 49. And then second will be a message of hope. First, however, the message of futility. And notice the first thing about the message, that the first message is about the girl. And notice the words that are spoken about her in 8:49a. While he was still speaking, and what that means, that Jesus had made no attempt to hurry up. He was taking his own time. And while he was still speaking, someone came from the house of the synagogue official saying, "Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." First of all, notice the words are very blunt. Let me give the way they are in the Greek. The first thing in verse 49 is not "your daughter." Your first words are, "She has died." She has died. And I'll underscore that because it's one single perfect tense verb. Perfect tense, remember, completed action with abiding results. Completed action with the accompanying abiding results. So the idea is she is dead. And all the accompaniments of death are with it. In other words, not just merely she has died. If he wanted to emphasize the word that he's just died, he'd use an aorist. She has died. The event has taken place. He uses a perfect. She has died, and all of the effects of death have begun to set in. One old commentator, he kind of put it kind of bluntly, he put it this way. Back in the 1800s. She has died and become stiff. Well, he did a good job with the perfect tense, because the death has occurred and the things that accompany the death are along with it. So there can be no doubt that she has died. And then, and again, those are the words, she's dead. And the results of death are now with us. Second, your daughter. Your daughter is not first. First, it's the news that a girl has died. And by the way, it's your daughter. So that's the force. She has died, perfect tense. And by the way, that's your daughter. Emphasizing the filial relationship. Now notice one other thing. She had died. It's his daughter. And Jesus was talking with others when it happened. As though Jesus disregarded, well, he did. He started toward the house. He didn't get there in time. And the death took place while Jesus was, what, halfway there? We don't know how far, but halfway there. At any rate, he wasn't there in time. And therefore, the message offers no hope whatsoever. And by the way, to get the force of this, we ought to trace out Jesus' actions toward Jairus. Number one, when Jairus asked him to come to his house, notice he asked for nothing more than his presence. You come down to chapter 8 with the description of it, and at verse 41, "Behold, there came a certain man named Jairus. He was an official of the synagogue, fell at Jesus' feet, and began to entreat him to come to his house." Notice, he asked for nothing but his presence, and Jesus promised nothing but his presence. He didn't promise to heal. The man just said, come to my house. And Jesus said, I'll come to your house. And so Jesus had promised Jairus nothing more than his presence. Notice also with the interruption with the woman, plus the fact that when that happened, he kept on talking to the crowd. So second observation, he made no attempt to arrive at the house quickly. He didn't run. He didn't sprint. He didn't call for a horse. He just took his own sweet time. Healed a woman on the way, and that started up a conversation, so he goes on and teaches. And let me say, if you'd been Jairus, wouldn't you have been doing a slow burn? In the first place, I would have been burning over that woman. You interrupted Jesus in such a way. You are so selfish. You weren't on the verge of death. And yet for your own comfort and your own healing, you stopped Jesus. And Jesus, you're not without fault. You stopped, didn't you? And when the lady had departed and you'd said, depart, your faith has made you whole, what did you start doing again? You started teaching the crowd again. So if you can get into this, and remember, Jairus was no different than you and you and I would be. He had all the feelings, all of the emotions that we would have had, and that makes him a very remarkable man. And in the midst of all of this, he hears that his daughter has now died. What, and it's obvious the Lord's dealing with this man to increase his faith. Between his calling for Jesus to come to his house and heal his daughter, what had he just witnessed? He'd just witnessed the healing of that woman. What should we say? Verse 48 was preparation for verse 49. Verse 48, as he sees a miracle performed, he now is going to get an opportunity for a greater miracle. So the message is one of futility. It focuses on the girl, and it also focuses on Jesus. About the girl, and now on Jesus. And that's the last part of 49. Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the teacher anymore. So with the remark that he has died, notice that the scene has moved from one of difficulty from the human standpoint to one of impossibility. And may we assert, and I'll give you a couple of passages with it, God never does anything significant as long as there's human hope left. As long as there's human hope, there's usually no divine remedy at all. And it's only when we get thrown back on the Lord and on the Lord again that we have hope. It would be fun. I started to collect them and ran out of time. Collect all of the biblical all human hope is lost passage. There are dozens of those kinds of passages in the Old Testament where there's nothing left. For example, 2 Chronicles 20. I'll turn to one that you're familiar with. 2 Chronicles 20, you know what it is before I get there. I'm kidding. 2 Chronicles 20. There are many, many other passages like it. And it's the all human help is gone type situation. 21 through 3. It came about after that the sons of Moab and the sons of Ammon, together with some of the Menuhites, came to make war against Jehoshaphat. Then some came and reported Jehoshaphat, saying, a great multitude is coming against you from beyond the sea, and out of Aram, and behold, they are in, that is in Gedi. And Jehoshaphat was afraid and turned his attention to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And then you come down to verse 12. O our God, wilt thou not judge them? For we are powerless before this great multitude. who are coming out against us, nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are on thee. And notice it's one of those no human help left passages that becomes the focal point here. You can think of Israel coming to the Red Sea. They come to the Red Sea. The Egyptians are in pursuit. They can't walk into the water. They can't turn around without being impaled on Egyptian spears. They can't go to the right. They can't go to the left. And what does Moses say? Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. And there are many, many, many such passages as that in the Old Testament. But let's go back to Luke. Question. When Jesus heard the message that your daughter has died, how did he respond? What did he do? Well, as far as he was concerned, they never even said it. He doesn't even respond to what they say. But when Jesus heard this, he answered him. Notice this is Jairus, not the people. He answered him, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe, and she will be made well." First of all, the message of futility, and now verse 50, the message of hope. Futility and now hope. And the message of hope begins down at verse 50. First of all, the fear that is here, and our translation has done pretty well. There are two ways, or two meanings, of the words translated in English, "do not fear." And they're distinct in Greek. The first one means, "do not start to fear." It means you haven't done it yet. Don't start it. The other construction means stop fearing. And that means you are doing it. Quit it. The first one means you are not doing it. Don't. For example, when Jesus spoke to Nicodemus and said, "Marvel not that I say to you, you must be born again," he uses the first one. And apparently he looks at Nicodemus, and Nicodemus is being blown away by what Jesus teaches. And Jesus says, "Now don't go crazy. Don't lose your mind. Don't even begin to marvel that I said to you, you must be born again." This one, in this context, means Jairus was full of fear. Stop it. And our translation has done pretty well with this. And how has it brought that out? "Do not be afraid." And how has it brought out the, stop it? Italicized words, "any longer." That's pretty good, isn't it? Do not fear any longer. And that allows for the Greek structure, which is present tense plus the word "may," meaning stop what you're doing. So stop fearing. It means that he was fearing. Now, can you do that? Can you do a negative action? Just say, "Stop being afraid." Haven't you heard people say, "Well, now don't be afraid," and you've got every reason under God's heaven to be afraid? And you want to say, "What do you mean, don't be afraid?" You know? Or get a pat on the hand and they say, "Oh, remember Romans 8:28 still in the book?" I love that one. And how do you stop? Well, you can't stop fearing by stopping fearing. The remedy, notice, is found in the latter part. "But only believe." In other words, faith in the Lord is the alternative. Now, how can he, what is he supposed to believe? Well, he's got three things going from him. Number one, he's got Jesus' presence. second, he's got his promise. Third, he has access to his power. Now focus here. And when you focus here, the fear will go away. I can illustrate that good. Someone sent me, Betty had showed it to me several weeks ago, and sometimes men turn off what their wives are saying and say, uh-huh. And I guess I did. Because I got in the mail yesterday from someone in Colorado, a little cartoon. What's it called? Family? What? Family? What? Family Circus. And it's clever, but it's so profound. You get the first picture, and there's this little boy in bed, and you know how the thoughts are put in a little balloon above the, in the balloon. Here's a picture of sheep jumping over the thing, and he's going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, counting all the sheep. And he calls his little sister in, second picture. And she's standing by the side of the bed, and he says, I think her name was Dolly. He says, Dolly, I have been counting sheep just like I've always been taught to do. And Dolly says, don't you remember what Grandma always says? Forget the sheep and talk to the shepherd. And in the last picture, all these Z's are going up. And this is very much, you know, his was sleeplessness. But how do you do? Forget the sheep. Focus on the shepherd. And that's exactly what he's coming here, is forget your fears, Jairus. It is true she is dead. It is a fact that this is the case. But focus where you ought to focus. And notice, you come down to verse 50. By the way, the word believe points to an event. It's an aorist tense. Do not go on being afraid anymore. Only do something definite. Believe. And there's somewhat of a committal in that idea. Just simply an act of faith, and she shall be made well. Now notice in the following context, you have a total scene of confusion. And it begins in verse 51. And when he had come to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the girl's father and mother. Notice the exclusion here. Now, it's true that all of the disciples were witnesses to the teaching of Jesus and the miracles of Jesus. But there were three men that always got picked out for special things. And they were Peter, James, and John. For example, when Jesus went on the mountain to be transfigured, who did he take with him? Only Peter, James, and John. When he prayed in the garden, who was it that he took with him to pray? Only three. Peter, James, and John. Now you could say, why? I'll only give a suggestion. Maybe right, maybe wrong. Peter, because it's on his confession that the church is built. So if it's on his confession that the church is built, isn't it especially important for Peter to be there to see the raising of the dead? John was just a favorite. The Gospel of John, 13:23, 19:26, 20:2, 21:7, 21:20, says that Jesus loved John. John was simply a special place in the heart of the Lord. James, perhaps this is the reason, he was the first one to die for Christ. Acts chapter 12, 1 through 3. So perhaps these are the men that needed an extra dose of, you were right there in the same room when it happened. So with that, the words of Jesus, verse 52, they were all weeping and lamenting for her, but he said, stop weeping, for she has not died, but is asleep. Question, is she dead or is she not? And some come along at this point and say, Jesus simply knew that she was in a coma of some sort. And they therefore teach this as a miracle of omniscience. Everybody thought she was dead. But Jesus knew she was not dead. If that's the case, you've got a miracle of omniscience. Can you see anything and read through verse 56 and tell me why you can't accept that? You see anything there that says she really died? What is death? It's when the soul and spirit leave the body, is it not? Do you see anything here that says she really did die? How about verse 55? Yeah. Her spirit returned. So the spirit had separated from the body and it now returned. So I take it then that, yes, the girl really died. You say, well, what does it mean then when Jesus says, stop weeping for she has not died? And by the way, that's not the only time he said that. He said it with Lazarus. When they said he is dead, he says he only sleeps. What does he mean then? Does he mean that the death wasn't real for Lazarus or the death wasn't real for this one? I take it the best way to interpret is he's simply saying death is not to be the last word of the day. Not to deny that she hasn't died, but she has not died in the sense of a cessation, but is asleep, and they began laughing at him, knowing that she had died. However, he took her by the hand, saying, and another account says he said, Talitha cum, which would be her native language. Can you take verse 54, and when he says, child, arise, what does he not say that you would expect him to say? In verse 52, stop weeping, for she has not died, but is asleep. Wake up. He doesn't say wake up. He says rise. Now, it is true that one of the common expressions in Aramaic for get out of bed is Talitha cum. Who knows how many times her mother had said to this 12-year-old girl, Talitha cum, meaning wake up physically. So it wasn't a new expression, it was a common expression. But notice in contrast to awake out of physical sleep, Jesus uses the same phrase and says rise out of death. And the girl comes forth, her spirit returns, she rose immediately, he gave orders for something to be given her to eat. I like the comment that talks about Jesus on this particular point was powerful because he raised her from the dead, and he was also practical in that he gave her something to eat. And her parents were amazed, but he instructed them to tell no one what had happened. And so notice you have now ultimately the ultimate power of Jesus, the power of Jesus over death. Now let me make a few observations. First one is this, and I'm not going to write these out. Faith reveals itself in different ways in different people. Jairus came courageously, but secretly feared. The woman came forth timidly, but was secretly strong in faith. You notice the contrast in these verses, the anxiety of the father, the timidity of the woman, the restlessness of the people, the composure of Jesus, the sensitivity of Jesus to the woman's touch, the insensitivity of the disciples to that, and major point. There are times when faith is disappointed, and we are then told, keep on believing. That's exactly what happened. The man came in hope and faith that his daughter wouldn't die. She died. And he had to be disappointed. But there are times when, as here, the Lord says, keep on, I know you've been disappointed, keep on believing, there is much, much more to learn. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word. Help us to recognize the wisdom in which you deal with us. For wisdom is one thing that we do not have. We attempt to be wise and engage in wise action. But when we see your activity and how it so often contradicts human wisdom, we have to admit you are the only wise God, and we therefore gladly bend the knee to thee in Christ's name.